Om Vishnu Pare. Sri Chaitanya Manavishtam, Svatitam Vendite, Svayam Sukhramayam Dadati Sapandatikam. Vanshikapadurvyascha, Pipasanyavayavaja, Patitanam Brahmanevyo, Vaishnavevyo, Namo Namaha. More or less, by definition, no one thinks, at least in a theoretical way, that they can understand the Supreme Absolute Truth. The atheists say that there is no God, there is no Supreme. Okay, aside from them, there are the agnostics who say that, yes, maybe there is a Supreme Truth, but he's unknowable. Their conclusion, even though it is based on something true, the truth is that the absolute truth is unknowable because he is unlimited and he is beyond the conception of everyone. Because we are finite, we are tiny, we have no conception of eternity, we have no conception of the greatest, we have no conception of the smallest. We are tiny, we are insignificant. So the agnostics in that sense are correct by saying that we cannot say anything about the absolute truth by our own power, but they are not correct because they refuse to make any commitment to the absolute truth, to Krishna, to God, to the Supreme Controller. They refuse to say that he is at all knowable. Just like if I'm a very mysterious person and I've come from a faraway land and I just walk in here and no one knows me and no one has seen anyone like me before. And everyone can say, we don't know anything about this person. But if I say, I'm like this, and I'm like this, and my mother's name is this, and this is what I like to do, and this is the food I like to eat. Because you don't know, we don't know anything about the Supreme by our own power, doesn't mean that we cannot know anything about him. Because if he decides to describe certain parts of himself, of course no one can understand him completely. Krishna explains this in the beginning of the 10th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Even the great sages and the demigods, they cannot know Krishna completely. What to speak of us non-demigods and non-sages? We cannot know Krishna completely, but that doesn't mean that he's fully unknowable, because he reveals wonderful aspects of himself to the world to attract us to him. Now, this particular pastime, which the chapter is titled "Krishna Steals the Gopis' Garments," is one of those amazing pastimes or activities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead that really show him as inconceivable if we accept, in fact, that he is doing these type of things. He is inconceivable, and we cannot take our minds and say, well, if I was to do something like this, there would be this motivation or that motivation. We cannot take our minds, our tiny minds that are very finite and contaminated by so much selfishness and controlled by goodness, passion, ignorance, and superimpose those upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead. No, when Krishna acts, He acts in very, very special ways, very, very wonderful ways. And when we can, even Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that yad yara charati shrestas tantami vitro jana, that he works and he acts in such a way that he sets an example for the world. Because if he did not work, Krishna explains, that the world would go to ruination. Everyone would follow his example of non-working. So Krishna sets up examples, the ideal warrior, the ideal householder, the ideal this, the ideal that. But that is not a full manifestation of his true nature. Because his true nature is completely independent. He doesn't, just like a father may act in a certain way just to help in the upbringing of his children because of his affection for his children. But that's not all there is to the father. And in his private times, in his most intimate times, he lets more of his actual nature be revealed. So Krishna here does something so incredible that's beyond the concept of God. This is the concept of the absolute truth who is completely independent. And why does he act in these ways? Because he's completely independent. There are reasons in there, but yet he acts in these ways ultimately. Why? Because he wants to. But his acting because he wants to in a particular way is completely different from the whimsical ways that we act when we want to just do something because we feel like doing it. He is the absolute truth. He is beyond all the conceptions that we can muster within our consciousness. There is no kam, krodh, lobh, moha. There is no lust, anger, greed. There is nothing, no illusion. He's omniscient, omnipotent. He knows everything. He's all powerful. And yet he acts. And he acts on different levels at different times. And this particular pastime is when he is acting in an incredible, wonderful way that is, practically speaking, impossible for the material mind to conceive of. And I've picked some little sections of, just two sections of purports, that from, not from this canto, not from the 10th canto, but from the first canto, when there's in the first canto in chapters 7 to 11, to the end of 11, from the middle of chapter 7 of the first canto to the end of chapter 11, there is a glimpse. And the only glimpse, practically speaking, that you get a bit of a glimpse in the beginning of the third canto of Krishna's activities in Vrindavan, when Vidura and Uddhava are speaking, and Uddhava, he gives some verses summarizing Krishna's pastimes inside and outside of Vrindavan. But aside from that, this first canto, these chapters are very, very intimate. And they give a wonderful glimpse of Krishna acting. And what occurs in these chapters is we see that which motivates the all-powerful, the all-knowing, the all-beautiful, that which motivates him to act more than anything else is to give pleasure to his devotees. So here is one purport, or part of a purport, in the 11th chapter, text 36. The Lord, Prabhupada explains, the Lord is all perfect. He's Atmarama. Atmarama means he gets pleasure from himself only. He has no need to look externally for pleasure. So he's Atmarama, or self-sufficient. He does not require anyone's extraneous help for his personal satisfaction. Practically speaking, by definition, because the absolute truth means that which is all-inclusive by definition. He includes everything, so it's not even possible for him to go external to himself for his happiness, because there is nothing external to him, because all that exists is the Supreme Lord and his different energies, Tritiya Shakti Uchate, the internal energy, Chatragya Kya Tatapara, the marginal energy, Chit Shakti, Maya Shakti, Jiva Shakti, the external energy, the world, its ingredients, and the controlling forces in the spiritual world, and he himself, and the different living entities. This is all part of the absolute truth, because the absolute truth, by definition, is all inclusive. So he doesn't need to go outside of himself. So what happens in this 11th chapter is when Krishna returns to Dwarka, all the different residents of Dwarka express their love for him, and then Krishna enters the palaces of his queens. Now, Krishna has 16,108 queens, and each one has a huge, gorgeous palace. Now, the first thing is one can think of is, how is it possible for anyone to have 16,108 queens and 16,108 palaces? And indeed, it is not possible for anyone of this world. But for Krishna, who is unlimited, he could have 16,000 million queens and 16,000 million palaces and 16,000 billion queens, or trillion, or quadrillion queens, and each one could have a palace. Because he's unlimited. We cannot conceive of how powerful the unlimitedly powerful is. But unlimitedly powerful. He could have unlimited queens and have unlimited palaces and be with each one of them simultaneously. So with his 16,000 queens and 16,000 palaces, it describes in the Bhagavatam that Narada Muni, that great sage, saw Krishna marry them all at once. He married 16,000 queens all at once. So one can think, well, that's not inconceivable. Let's put him in a huge, huge, huge hall, a cricket stadium or something, and marry them all at once. But no, Krishna didn't do that. Oh, one could think, oh, he married 16,000 queens, he could marry them one after another, you know, like 200 a day or something like that. It would take some time. It would take a year or something like that to marry them all. But no. Krishna married them all at the same time, but in different places. Not in one place. And Krishna himself was present in each of the places, 16,108 places, expanding himself. So this is more than extraordinary. This is incredible. But for Krishna to do something incredible is not difficult, because he's all powerful and all knowing and all beautiful and all. He's the absolute truth. So this particular part of the Bhagavatam at the end of the 11th chapter of the first canto, Krishna enters into the palaces of the queens of Dwarka, and he's seeing them for the first time after being away for some time. And their interaction between the queens who love him so much and Krishna is very, very wonderful. It's not described in detail, but it's very, very wonderful. And Krishna basically has each one of those 16,108 queens convinced that they are their pet queen, And Krishna is always with them because he loves them the most. And of course, they don't, by the influence of Krishna's potencies, they don't know that Krishna is expanding himself and things like that. But they're shyly smiling at Krishna, and Krishna appears to be going under their influence of their control of their feminine natures and things like that. So Prabhupada explains, the queens could not satisfy their lord by their feminine attractiveness, but they satisfied him by their sincere affection and service. That is what Krishna was reciprocating with. When we deal with someone in this world, no matter what it appears to look like, there's always something in it for us. And if we're not getting more than we're giving, we start feeling very frustrated that this arrangement isn't very good. That's business. It's not love, actually. But in the spiritual world, true love, Krishnendriya Priti Icha Dari Premanam, this exists because everyone wants to serve Krishna and Krishna and increase Krishna's happiness. This is the nature of the spiritual world. This is the nature of the loving nature of Goloka Vrindavan in the spiritual world. And what does Krishna do? Does he just simply sit there and everyone, I've created everyone to love me, and I sit there and have 16 quadrillion, billion, million servants serving me? And this is the way it goes? No, Krishna isn't like that. But his interest is to serve all those who are serving him and increase their happiness to the highest degree. So Krishna is known as Bhakta Vatsalya Atma Parjanta Vadanyata, that he gives himself to his devotees, and he's a devotee of his devotees. The Supreme Lord, this all-powerful person, what does he like to do? What gives him pleasure? He who has Icha Shakti, which means that all his desires immediately come to pass, where does he get his pleasure? And the answer is by serving. We're all interested in becoming masters, and the Supreme Master is interested in serving. How ironic. And because we have that interest, we stay in the material world. So these queens, what was keeping Krishna there? They were satisfying him by their sincere affection and service. Only by unalloyed, transcendental loving service. Unalloyed means no mixtures of any other desire. Transcendental means it has nothing to do with the love of this world. It is true love. It is not love mixed with so many other selfishnesses. So only by unalloyed, transcendental loving service could they satisfy the Lord. And the Lord was pleased to treat them as wives in reciprocation. Yayatam mam prapadyante. They want to serve Krishna in the loving mood that a wife serves a husband. And that causes Krishna to act as a loving husband towards them. It is their mood that Krishna is reciprocating with. Thus, being satisfied by their unalloyed service only, the Lord reciprocated the service just like a devout husband. But yet, he is the absolute truth. Otherwise, he had no business becoming the husband of so many wives. He is the husband of everyone, but to one who accepts him as such, he reciprocates. How we wish to deal with Krishna, Krishna will deal with us in a reciprocal way. If we want to think, as an atheist may, that God doesn't exist, then Krishna will treat us in a reciprocal way and act as if we don't exist for him. If we want to treat him with love, if we want things from him, he'll give us things. If we wanted to treat him with love, he will treat us with love. He wishes that. And he always gives more. But yet, the basic principles that he reciprocates with us exactly. Yayatam Rampapajante. Krishna reciprocates. This unalloyed affection for the Lord is never going to be compared to mundane lust, which is Atma Indriya Priti, Vansha Tare Bhale Kam, that it is selfish, basically. There's always trying to get more than one gives. Always. That is the nature of lust. Like business. If some businessman is very, very nice to us and giving us some thumbs up and limka, we know he's doing that not because out of love and he invites us to our house, his house, to feed us. There's always some business motive. He's trying to get something, and he'll get more than he gives. Otherwise, there's no business. So this unalloyed affection for the Lord is never to be compared with mundane lust. It is purely transcendental. It is completely transcendental. It is beyond goodness and beyond passion and beyond ignorance. It is spiritual. It is based on love. It is eternal. It is spiritual love is Ladini Shakti, Radha Krishna Pranaya Vikritir, Ladini Shakti Asma. It is all taking place by the power of the internal spiritual energy. Even though its reflection in the material world seems very familiar, it actually has nothing to do with that reflection of the material world. Just like not that it has nothing to do, but the material world is simply a reflection of this reality, of the spiritual reality, and the reflection of the love in the spiritual world is perverted into the material world, and it lacks true substance, just like the reflection of the people walking on around the lake. The reflection, there's a path around the lake and the people are walking around the path and you can see the reflection of the people, but it's only a reflection. That's not where the real substance is. So similarly, that which takes place in the material world appears to be like, seems similar to the activities of the spiritual world, but in fact they have nothing to do with each other, just like the reflection in fact doesn't have anything to do with the actual reality of the people walking on the bank. Of course, the reflection again is a reflection of that reality. In the same way, the loving dealings in the material world, which are so unsatisfying, is in fact a reflection of the true dealings of the spiritual world. But they cannot be compared in value or in quality any more than iron can be compared to gold. Yes, they're both metals, but they're of a completely different quality. So Prabhupada continues with one more line here. And the grave dealings which the queens display in a natural feminine way were also transcendental, because the feelings were expressed out of transcendental ecstasy, the feelings of love for Krishna. It was all transcendental spiritual ecstasy. And it was very grave, Prabhupada says, the grave dealings. What does grave mean? It means very, very, very deep. We cannot penetrate into their mood if our own consciousness is superficial and material. Because they are very, very deep. Their love is deep. It is pure. It is unalloyed. It is unmixed. It is transcendental. It is true. It has substance. It is spiritual. So again, Why does Krishna act as he does? And as he displays, why does he walk in? Why does he have palaces? Why doesn't he live with his queens in straw huts? And why does Krishna like the flute? Why not the... either electric guitar or trombone or something, or a tuba. Why didn't Krishna play the tuba? And as soon as the alto saxophone. Now that's a good instrument. So as soon as you say Krishna plays the flute, someone's going to say, well, why doesn't he do this? Why doesn't he do that? Why does he like cows? Why doesn't he like goats? Why wasn't he a goatherd boy? Why wasn't he a pigherdsman? Why didn't he like llamas, alpacas, sheep, monkeys? Oh, he did like monkeys. He wasn't a monkey herds boy, though. You can't herd monkeys. Why didn't he like cats? So as soon as you put anything definite, someone's going to say, why not this? Because from our point of view, why not? But why does Krishna do what he do? Why does he steal the clothes of the gopis? Why does he like cows? Why does he wear a peacock feather in his head? Why not an ostrich plume or an emu feather in his head? Yeah. Because he does what he wants. Because he is independent. Of course, we can say his taste is impeccable, and it is. Cows are much better than sheep, goats, etc. But aside from that, he is the independent supreme personality of Godhead. He is the every other person, every other thing in existence depends on him, ultimately. Just like I'm sitting, I can say I'm sitting on this. What am I sitting on? Say I'm sitting on an asana here, a seat. But one could also say I'm sitting on some cloth. My body is resting on the cloth, and the cloth is resting on a cushion, and the cushion is resting on the wood underneath, and the wood is resting on the legs, and the legs are resting on the wooden floor, and the wooden floor is resting on the concrete. Foundation pad, and the concrete foundation pad is resting on the earth, and the earth is resting on. I was just imagine that it's just like sitting in the air, but it's resting on something some potency. And where is that? What does that potency rest upon? So if you trace everything back, ultimately, this is what Sarvakarana Karna means. And we say, Govindam Adi Purusham Tamaham Bhajami Sarvakarana Karna. He is the cause of all causes. He is the thing that everything rests upon, the person, the absolute truth, that everything rests upon, but he doesn't rest upon anything. He is not dependent. He is the independent truth. We can say that it is true that I am right now resting or sitting upon the cloth, but that is a dependent truth. That truth is dependent on other truths, going all the way down to the earth, to the force of gravity or whatever. But Krishna is that truth that is completely independent, that everything rests on him, and yet he rests upon nothing. He is the self-sufficient, absolute personality of Godhead. And he, in fact, is the only one who can do exactly as he likes. So Prabhupada explains, he's the supreme independent. And the first verse of the Bhagavatam says that he's avijja sorat. This is part of the definition of the absolute truth. He's all-knowing. And he's completely independent. So again, he at times, or when he incarnates or acts as avatar and comes to this world, he usually and generally sets an example for humankind. so that they can follow it. Because if he acts inappropriately, doesn't work as the example he gives, then people will use that as an excuse. But yet he's still independent. He chooses to do that when he wants. But sometimes he displays higher principles of exchange of love with his devotees, as he's going to do in this chapter of the Bhagavatam. And sometimes he breaks all the rules of humankind just to show that he is above all the rules, and he demonstrates by this his superior position, and he demonstrates by this that the highest principle for him is to reciprocate love with his most intimate devotees. And this is what Krishna means, that Krishna is the Supreme Absolute Truth. He is completely independent. Now, so we're going to hear about how Krishna, he'll steal the clothes of the young damsels. Actually, the ones that we heard about in the last chapter who were speaking the verses of the glorifying Krishna's flute, they were all married. They talk about that. They were all caught up in their household affairs. And yet, they loved Krishna. And in the material world, that is considered completely immoral and improper to have a paramour. Just like in the tree's reflection, the lowest part of the reflection is the topmost leaves of the tree, the highest branches. But that lowest part in the actual reality of the tree, the top of the tree, is the highest part. So similarly, that which is the lowest things in the material reflected world is actually, these things are actually the highest thing in the spiritual world, because there is no lust there. It is all reciprocations of transcendental affection. There is no selfishness, there is love. Regardless of how it appears, it is just simply based on love. So who are these women? What is their position? So I'm pulling out again one of Prabhupada's purports, part of Prabhupada's purport in the 11th chapter of the first canto, when he's describing the quality, the qualification of the queens in Dwarka, who Krishna came into the palaces and acted as their husband. So just a short quotation. Prabhupada explains, "The women amongst he lived as their husband are not women of this mundane world, but they are eternally related with him as transcendental wives, a position which they attain by perfection of devotional service. As such, the Supreme Being, the Param Brahma," that means the Supreme Greatest. Brahma means great. "The Supreme Greatest," that's the Absolute Truth, Krishna. "He certainly does not seek his happiness anywhere in the material world, nor can his paraphernalia of happiness be found in the material world." So we can say that the pleasure that he gets is non-material. Or we could say that he gets no pleasure in this world. Or we could even make it shorter and say that he gets no pleasure. We could say that Krishna has no material form. And in some sense we could say he has no form, meaning no material form. But Krishna does get his pleasure in the spiritual world, because, as Prabhupada continues, he is not impersonal. Because he is the leader and the supreme being amongst innumerable living beings, he cannot be impersonal. He is exactly like us, and he has all the propensities of an individual living being in fullness, just like the actual tree on the bank of the lake has all the aspects of the reflection of the tree, but it has them in reality and in fullness. Instead of being a shallow reflection, the reflection of the sweet tasting fruit, mango, it has no taste, but the actual mango has everything that the reflection has, but has it in fullness. So similarly, Krishna has everything that we have, but in fullness, because we are reflections. This world is a reflection of the spiritual world. So we can say that Krishna has everything that we have in fullness, or we can say that we have everything that Krishna has in reflectiveness, and that everything that we have has its source in Krishna. As everything that we see reflected in the material pool has its source on the reality on the bank of the lake. So he's exactly like us, and he has all the propensities of an individual living being in fullness. He marries exactly like us, but his marriage is neither mundane nor limited by our experience in the conditioned state. His wives, therefore, appear like mundane women, but factually they are transcendental, liberated souls, perfect manifestations of the internal energy, of the spiritual energy. So Krishna is playing with his energies in his pastimes in Vrindavan. So now we can just get started and read a little of this, of the beginning of this pastime. So the previous pastimes in the last chapter, or two chapters ago, it was the description of the rainy season with a little bit of the pastimes of the rainy season and the description of autumn. And then in the previous chapter, in chapter 21, it described the pastimes of autumn. And here we're into the Hemanta season, or the winter season, after autumn, after the Sarat season, or Sarat month finishes, then the next season heralds the beginning of winter, and Vrindavan starts getting cold, very cold at that time. For several months it's quite cold, say 3 months, or 2 months, 2 months, it's quite cold. So this pastime, where he's going to steal the clothes of the gopis, takes place in the winter season. So here's how it begins. Sri Sukuvacha, the great sage Sukadev Goswami said, Hemante patame masi nandavaja kumarika chero havisham bunjana katyayani archana vratam. Sukadev Goswami said, during the first month of the winter season, the young unmarried girls of Gokul, so the previous chapter dealt with the married girls in Gokul, and here the young unmarried girls of Gokul, of Vrindavan, observe the vow of worshipping goddess Katyayani. For the entire month, they ate only unspiced khichdi. Here's the purport over here. The word Hemante refers to the month of Magha Shirsha, from approximately the middle of November to the middle of December, according to the Western calendar. In Volume 1, Chapter 22 of Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Srila Prabhupada comments that the gopis first ate havishyan, a kind of food prepared by boiling together mung dal and rice without any spices or even turmeric. According to Vedic injunction, this kind of food is recommended to purify the body before one enacts a ritualistic ceremony. So this was the part of their vow. When one performs a vow, one wants to get something. So the young gopis, because Krishna was unmarried, and they were unmarried, these are the unmarried gopis, they wanted to get something. And what did they want? They want to have Krishna as their husband, because everyone in Vrindavan loves Krishna. Everyone in Vrindavan loves Krishna. This is the qualification to enter into Vrindavan. It is love for Krishna. So each of the different persons there, personages there. They love Krishna in their own way according to the five different rasas, the five different varieties. Of course, there's individuality, so much individuality even in that. But there is the passivity, like the earth and the grass. They're not active. And then there's the dasyaras, or the servanthood. And then there is friendship with awe and reverence, and friendship with intimacy. And then there is vatsalya ras, or the way that parents love their children. The elderly people in Vrindavan love Krishna as parents love their children. And then there is the conjugal, or madhurya, or shringara rasa, where the young girls love Krishna as a lover or a boyfriend. But this again is completely transcendental. So their desire is to love Krishna and serve Krishna with 100% sincerity. They want Krishna's pleasure. And therefore, with 100% sincerity, Krishna wants to give them pleasure. So we'll read a little bit of Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur's comment here to this first verse. After describing the purvarag of the married gopis, such as Radhika, because Srimati Radharani had spoken one of the verses, and the Hante Anadriya Balahadidasa Varjo verse. Purvarag means previous to meeting. They were in love with Krishna just by seeing him and hearing about him. So that's previous to meeting, that is called purvarag. So after describing the purvarag of the married gopis, such as Radhika, towards Krishna in the autumn, the sarad season, there is a description of the purvarag of the unmarried nitya siddha gopis, such as Danya, in connection with the Himanta season. So this is Nityasiddha means they're eternally perfect, fully spiritual. Although in fact their loving affection for Krishna as an intimate associate was already established, still the Kanyakumaris, the young unmarried gopis, following the way of ordinary society, they perform worship of Katyayani Devi, appearing superficially to be a demigod, to attain Krishna as their husband. The second and third verse are together. So this is one difference between this old Vedic culture and the contemporary culture. People, when they wanted to get something, and it's even to this date, you sacrifice. You think that you need some help from above to gain what you want. But nowadays people think that they are independent fully in attaining their desires, even on the material level. And in this culture, and not only in the Vedic culture, but every religious culture, people think that they are dependent on higher authority to gain anything, to live, to exist, dependence on others. But now, in illusion, we think that we're independent. And therefore, as we become more and more independent, we become more and more lonely and more miserable. So they, to get what they wanted, didn't just plot and scheme. They did plot and scheme, but they plot and schemed in a dependent way. So they wanted to get blessings from the Devi, the demigoddess, Katyayani. So each of the young unmarried girls performed her worship. They got up early in the morning and they went to the bank of the Yamuna River, and it was very, very cold. They went to the bank of the Yamuna River. They performed their worship while chanting the following mantras. O Goddess Katyayani, O great potency of the Lord, O possessor of great mystic power, Almighty controller of all, please make the son of Nanda Maharaj my husband. I offer my obeisances unto you. So there were other aspects of the rituals, but this was their prayer. We'll just read a little bit from the purport here, and we'll read some of Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur's comment. According to various acharyas, the goddess Durga, or Kalyani, mentioned in this verse is not the illusory energy of Krishna called Maya, but rather the internal potency of the Lord known as Yoga Maya, the spiritual energy of Krishna, not the material energy that bewilders everyone in this world. And then we'll read just closer to the end. The Lord, and then he has some quotations. The Lord's inferior potency, known as Durga, is dedicated to his loving service. Being the Lord's potency, this inferior energy is none different from him. But there is another superior energy. So this is a quotation from the Narada Pancharatra to show who Krishna was actually worshiping, or the gopis were actually worshiping. There is another superior potency whose form is on the same spiritual level of God himself. Simply by scientifically understanding this supreme potency, one can immediately achieve the supreme soul of all souls, who is the Lord of all lords. There is no other process to achieve him but through the energy of his potency, by the mercy of his potency. Ultimately, that means Yoga Maya, or Srimati Radharani, or Vrinda Devi, or like that. That supreme potency of the Lord is known as Gokaleshwari, the goddess of Gokul. Her nature is to be completely absorbed in love of God, and through her one can easily obtain the primeval God, the Lord of all that be. This internal potency of the Lord has a covering potency known as Mahamaya, who rules the material world. In fact, she bewilders the entire universe, and thus everyone within this universe falsely identifies himself with his material body. So that Maya wasn't the potency that the gopis were worshipping. They were worshipping the true image, not the reflected image. So then the purport continues after that quotation from the Narada Pancharatra. Even if we accept hypothetically that the gopis were worshipping the external Maya, there is no fault on their part, since in their pastimes of loving Krishna, they were acting as ordinary members of society. Srila Prabhupada comments in this regard, the Vaishnavas generally do not worship any demigods. Srila Narottama Das Thakur has strictly forbidden all worship of the demigods for anyone who wants to advance in pure devotional service. Yet the gopis, who are beyond compare in their affection for Krishna, were seen to worship Durga. The worship of demigods was also sometimes mentioned, the worshippers of demigods also sometimes mention that the gopis also worship goddess Durga. But we must understand the purpose of the gopis. Generally, people worship goddess Durga for some material benediction. Here, the gopis could adopt any means to satisfy or serve Krishna. That was the super excellent characteristic of the gopis. And this is what will be shown in this chapter and throughout the whole Bhagavatam, is that anything, everything for Krishna, no other desire other than to please Krishna. And that complete sincerity completely conquers Krishna. So the quotation continues a little more. They worship goddess Durga completely for 1 month in order to have Krishna as their husband. Every day they prayed for Krishna, the son of Nanda Maharaj, to become their husband. And their motivation was to serve and love Krishna. Chakravarti Thakur The gopis prayed, O Katyayani,
please make the son of Nanda Maharaj my husband. This is the comment of Vishwanatha. But goddess Kayayani may object. When you say, please do it, what does that have to do with me? Why do I have to make the son of Nanda Maharaj your husband? You should be allowed to do whatever you wish in this matter. I, on the other hand, shall simply inspire your parents to do the needful. Therefore, you should rather use the word, please cause someone to do it. Well, please give this. Anticipating this objection, the gopis say in anxiety, O great yogini, my connection with Krishna should be immediately arranged by you, without the unnecessary disturbance of my parents. I'm too anxious for this and cannot wait. Besides, Krishna has not taken brahminical initiation yet, so he's not ready for marriage. Therefore, goddess, overlook the proper rituals of marriage, and in the Gandharva style, let us marry Krishna immediately. Such is the implication. Kayani may object, because they were so much in love with Krishna. They were young, completely innocent, but they loved Krishna so completely. They could not tolerate even a moment of separation from Krishna. They would criticize Brahma when their eyes would blink, because the blinking of the eyes would disallow them from seeing Krishna for a split moment. That was intolerable. Their love was so complete. So Kayayani may object, you're thinking of Krishna as your husband and are anxious to have your intimate connection with him even without your parents knowing. But how can I possibly fulfill this desire of yours? And the gopis reply, O Adishwari, you have all powers. Therefore nothing is impossible for you. You are Mahamaya, the supreme enchantress. Therefore by the power of illusion you should bewilder my parents, so that they will not know of my marriage and the secret of my intimate association with Krishna. They had only one desire, how to serve Krishna properly. And text 5. Thus, for an entire month, the girls carried out their vow and properly worshipped the goddess Bhadrakali, fully absorbing their minds in Krishna and meditating upon the following thought, may the son of King Nanda become my husband. Text 6. Each day they rose at dawn, and calling out to one another by name, they all held hands and loudly sang the glories of Krishna while going to the Yamuna River, the Kalindi, to take their bath. They went in their own groups. Srila Jiva Goswami says, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur comments, this verse continues the second verse description of the gopis going to the Yamuna by bathing. They called each other by name. Svai Gotrai. Oh, Danya, where are you? Why are you late? Very, very simple comment. Text 7. One day, as they came by the riverbank, and putting aside their clothing as they had done before, they began to happily play in the water while singing the glories of Krishna. Purport. According to Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, this incident occurred on the day that the young gopis completed their vow. It was the final day of the month. That means it was even more cold than at the beginning of the month, which was a full moon day. And the full moon day means it's even more cold. To celebrate the successful completion of their vow, the girls invited young Radharani, the daughter of Brishabhanu and the special object of their affection, along with other important gopis, and brought them all to the river to bathe. Their playing in the water was meant to serve as the avabhritya snan, the ceremonial bath taken immediately upon the completion of a Vedic sacrifice. Srila Prabhupada comments as follows, it is an old system amongst Indian girls and women that when they take bath in the river, they place their garments on the bank and dip into the water completely naked. The portion of the river where the girls and women take bath was strictly prohibited to any male, and this is still the system. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, knowing the minds of the unmarried gopis, what was in their mind, he awarded them their desired object. They had prayed for Krishna to become their husband, and Krishna wanted to fulfill their desire. Lord Krishna, this is text 8, the Supreme Personality of Godhead and master of all masters of mystic yoga, was aware of what the gopis were doing. And thus he went there, surrounded by his young companions, to award the gopis the perfection of their endeavor. Purport. As the master of all masters of mystic powers, Lord Krishna could easily understand the desires of the gopis, and also he could fulfill them. The gopis, like all young girls from respectable families, considered the embarrassment of appearing naked before a young boy to be worse than giving up their lives. Yet Lord Krishna made them come out of the water and bow down to him. Although he's very naughty on the transcendental platform, but still very naughty. Yet, although the bodily forms of the gopis were all fully developed, and although Krishna met them in a secluded place and brought them fully under his control, because the Lord is completely transcendental, there was not a trace of material desire in his mind. Lord Krishna is the ocean of transcendental bliss, and he wanted to share his bliss with the gopis on the spiritual platform, completely free of ordinary lust. So it is impossible, practically speaking, for us to understand this. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains that the companions of Krishna mentioned here were mere toddlers, 2 or 3 years old. They were completely naked and were unaware of the difference between male and female. When Krishna went out to herd the cows, they followed him because they were so attached to him that they could not bear to be without his association. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments, text 8. He's quoting from the Krama Dipika. Krishna was surrounded by babies who spoke in broken language. These were the associates of Krishna, who wore tiger nails around their necks and tinkling bells around their waists, and who had fat thighs. The Vaishnava Toshini, Sanatana Swami, quoting from Gautamiya Tantra, lists the names of the boys as Dama, Sudam, Vasudam, and Kinkini. They were all the very personification of Krishna's heart. And text 9, the final text we'll read today. Tasham Vasham Yupadaya Nipamaruha Sadvara Hasadbi Prahasan Balai Parishasamuvachaha. Taking the girl's garments, he quickly climbed to the top of a kadamba tree, a nipa tree. Then, as he laughed loudly, and his companions also laughed, he addressed the girls jokingly. So, from text 20 to text 10 to 20 is Krishna's joking words, 11 texts with the gopis in their joking replies. Okay, we'll stop here. Any questions? Comments?
Where was Krishna's companions, boyfriend companions?
Sounds like it was very, very early in the morning.
But they, coming up, it was just Krishna and those gopis, but this companion, who's boyfriend companions?
But they're not the usual ones. These are little 2 and 3 year old ones.
Oh, boys.
Toddlers. Little kids. Yeah. His young companions, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur said that the companions of Krishna mentioned were mere toddlers, 2 or 3 years old. They were completely naked also, because the kids in India, they walk around like that. And they were unaware of the difference between male and female. Completely innocent. So when Krishna went out to herd the cows, they followed him, but this seems a little early for that. But yes, they went. Somehow Krishna was there with them. Of course, everyone in Vrindavan loves Krishna, so they could not bear to be without his
his association. The Krishna, he goes with the cows, but the calves who Krishna used to tend previously would also go because they could not bear to be without Krishna's association. The trees, when Krishna would walk into the forest of Vrindavan, they would give fruit. The bees would come around. The birds would sing. The peacocks would dance. Everyone just simply loved Krishna, Krishna's associate. And then when Krishna would leave, all the forest animals, when he would go home at the night, all the forest animals, the deer and the little whatever, squirrels, I don't know if there were little squirrels around, but everyone, they would all walk to the end of the forest and just simply wait there till the next day when Krishna would again enter. This is Vrindavan. This is the spiritual world. And as soon that we have pure, unalloyed love for Krishna in that in a particular mood, and it's pure and unalloyed, and it's fully developed, we'll be there. We can be there, even if in this body. Or would we rather play in the reflection pool, trying to get the taste of a mango and wondering why the mango's tasting very watery today? Just trying to eat the reflection and finding it quite unsatisfactory and unsatisfying. Tamasima Lutigama. Any other questions or comments? Yeah.
You mentioned maybe Tom and Pajan saying how we deal with Krishna's presence at all. Or how does he deal with mature devotees who haven't yet developed love or even pure practice of love?
For every step we take towards him, he takes 10 or 100 to us, or 1,000. Heard it in different ways, but very, very kindly and merciful. Just like how when a child is naughty, or when he leaves his parents and he's doing his silly things, the child may even forget the parents, but the parents never forget the child. It's just the nature of that type of love. So the Krishna is more eager to bring us to him than we are to go with him. So he reciprocates in a wonderful way with every good gesture that we make. But yet it's proportionate, but it's not equal. It's not one-to-one proportionate. Ye bhajanti tumam bhaktya maya tatesya chapyaham. Special. Not samoham savabhuteshu, not equal. Yes.
I was thinking that some of the pastimes of Krishna, there's instruction in them, and when you hear them, you can relate to what you should learn. And some of the pastimes, like in this particular section of Bhagavatam, Krishna,
just for his own fun and pleasure.
So,
but there is something we can learn from this. I happened to see something that either Bhaktivinoda Thakur mentioned about this pastime, or Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. I think it was Bhaktivinoda Thakur. He said, we should not hide anything from Krishna.
There's an explanation like that, that the gopis were ready to just completely...
They are fully surrendered.
...away, and let Krishna see them. And how we have so many coverings up, like the clothes, and we won't let anyone see. And it looks like we're very chaste, because we keep ourselves covered and distant. But the gopis were so simple that they... And Prabhupada says that Krishna treated them like dancing wooden dolls.
Yes.
But these pastimes, they're very difficult to explain. explain to somebody who doesn't have the three concepts?
That's why I spent most of the class trying to, because this is so extraordinary, and it's so similar to the dealings between young boys and girls in this world, that we wanted to make the point strongly and clearly that even though it appears similar, it has nothing to do with it. Just like the actual reflection has nothing to do with the substance of the thing that it's reflecting. Of course it does, because it's a reflection. But it's water and substance. It's water, something that looks like mango, and the real thing. So therefore, one is supposed to read the first 9 cantos, and then the first 20 chapters, and then the 21st chapter before reading the 22nd chapter. It's a big book. So the one learns a lot by doing it that way. Otherwise, the mind will be affected and thinking, treating it as mundane, and you won't even have any intelligence to argue with the mind, practically speaking.
Because sometimes in India, Christians, missionaries, and so forth, when they would go to India, they would point to these sections of the Bhagavatam and say,
one did that to me in Bangladesh. Said, how could you worship a god who he said dances with the wives of others in the middle of the night? But he could have said it steals the clothes of young gopis. He could have said that too. And what do you say? You actually don't understand what God is. That's actually the point. How independent is he? And that the activities of Krishna and the spiritual world, they are not for you who have mundane consciousness, actually. They are not actually for you. You're too far away.
There's I think somewhere also Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur commented on how some Christian monk or something came to Vrindavan and challenged the resident devotees of Vrindavan with these questions, and they couldn't defeat him. And Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said before, it can be understood that they are only neophytes. They couldn't actually present authoritatively how this person defeated arguments on how and why Krishna is able to do whatever he wants.
So may Prabhupada's mercy and by the mercy of Guna time, maybe we get the requisite purity to be able to hear these things in a legitimate way. Okay, thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srimad Prabhupada ki jai, Bhava Bhaktivinoda ki jai.